Alright, let me ask you a couple of questions on, and this is something that has been discussed before and I get asked occasionally. So I think it would be appropriate to put on the tape. You cannot find in the text of the Torah where Abraham's father was an idolater.
No, it doesn't mention
that. Alright. You find, if you look at the text, if I counted correctly, that Abraham is...
it does say in the Bible that he was an idolater. You know where it says it?
Where?
It says in Joshua. I took Abraham... where's that verse? From years ago, your forefathers were idol worshippers years ago, and I took Abraham from... and they serve strange gods. Where is it? I think it's Joshua. Is that going to have the source over there? You get me regular the other goddess. Or this one have it? Yeah, where it's a verse in. I believe it's in Joshua. I may be wrong, but here's the quote. Let me give you the quote. Joshua. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus said the Lord." I don't have where it is. The God of Israel of old, your fathers dwelt.
Where is the quote, Rabbi?
What?
Joshua, what?
Let me get the quote. I'll find a quote for you, okay? It's an open verse in the in Joshua. Let me just see. Hold on one second. You holding that tape there? Okay. Have you got it? 27? There's no 27. No.
There's no 27-2.
Oh, no, it is. It's 24-2. It's a mistake.
24-2.
24, it's a mistake.
And Joshua said unto all the people, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the river of old in Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods."
That's it.
Now, there it is. That works.
Yep.
You're amazing. All right, so there it is. There's the quote. I need to write that one. I'm going to have to put a little note on that one.
Joshua
24:2. Okay, you made your point.
Okay. So that's why what Rashi is explaining over here is that from the house of your father to the land which I will show you. So in other words, what God was telling Abraham is, I'm not going to tell you right now where that land is. Why? Because if I tell you where that land is, you're just going to attach your emotions to that place, and you're just going to think this is my new home. I want you to wander aimlessly.
Rabbi, yes. We have a question. This is Mrs. Gail Ledford.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, what?
Just talk.
Okay.
Right, don't touch it. I'll hold it.
Rabbi.
Yes.
You gave commentary on Genesis where. And you went backwards in two verses. You went from 12:1 back to the end of chapter 11.
Right.
You gave commentaries like it was in that chronological order. Is it not possible that it's not in chronological order?
No, because that's not possible because over here, before it states that Terach took his son. And if you reverse the order, then what you're going to have is you're going to have a problem if you reverse the order. There are other interpretations besides Rashi, by the way. There are other interpretations. And there is the problem with the other interpretation is, if you reverse the order, then what happens is that over here, it's the prime mover is Abraham, whereas in the verse in Genesis 11:31, the prime mover is Terach. So that would be a problem. But there are other opinions. I'm expounding Rashi's position. It is you're asking your question is very good. It's an insightful question because there are other commentaries that try to work it out differently along those lines. But I'm limiting myself to Rashi's interpretation. I think that Rashi's is the most textual as he usually is, and I think there's if you follow Rashi. You see, it explains everything, and it gives a great insight into the text itself. Okay? But your point is an excellent point. You're thinking. Okay. All right. So let me continue with our interpretation. Now Rashi. Now according to Rashi, the verse now this whole verse becomes converted to a new phenomenon. I mean, originally we looked at the verse, a little story. God tells Abraham, go, you know, leave the house of your father and go. I'm going to make you a great person, famous, etc. But now we take a look at this verse and we see every word here counts. And it's a whole different journey that Abraham went on. It wasn't so much a physical journey. Yes, it was a strange physical journey. He had to wander aimlessly, not knowing, not being able to attach himself to any place. I mean, you know, like a man without a country is a very difficult emotional kind of thing to face. Why? Because a person feels insecure. I mean, we don't realize how much security we have. The fact that we live in a town and a country, this has an effect on the whole psyche of a person. What God demanded of Abraham was to call that up, wander aimlessly, didn't know where he was going. This is according to everybody, by the way. Because it says that that's clear according to everybody that he wandered aimlessly. That of course God didn't disclose which land he's going to go to. So according to Rashi, the text fits beautifully, and that's why the order is reversed, because Rashi explains that God, in giving Abraham this commandment, what he did was he raised him to a higher level. He removed all kinds of emotional attachments and security, and didn't even tell him where he's going to go. Now Rashi explains. See, Rashi says in a similar fashion, God works the same way. Again, when he tells Abraham to take his son Isaac, he doesn't immediately say Isaac. First he says, take your son. That's in 22. He says, take your son. Now, Abraham had two sons. He had Ishmael. So at that point, Abraham is grappling with the motion, which son will it be? Then he says, your only son. Your only son, well, there's still two. What does only mean? The one that you love. Which one is that? Isaac. So God zeroes in slowly. And for every expression, it was a different emotion that took place in Abraham's mind.
Rabbi, does that mean that he didn't love Ishmael?
Not like he did Isaac. You see, originally, you have to understand something. When Abraham said to God, God said to Abraham, your reward is very great. So Abraham responded to God. Abraham said, God, what will you, what can you give me? And I have no children. And the one, the master of my household is Eliezer Damascus. So what was Abraham's request? It wasn't a personal request. It was a request because he realized that the system cannot continue without a son. If he didn't have a son, the whole philosophy would die. As great as Eliezer was, and the rabbis tell us Eliezer was one of the greatest men ever. He was really close to Abraham and he close to God and everything. But nevertheless, the system could, as a system and a nation, it would never work. It had to be a son. A son is a different feeling, and the son was, the world recognized the son as, that's the authentic. He took over his father's ideas, his father's world of ideas. He knows the ideas, and this is a psychological phenomenon. So, at first Abraham thought that the son that's going to take over is Ishmael. If you remember, Abraham said to God, when God mentioned to him about a son, he's going to have another son. Abraham said, "I'll be happy if Ishmael will live." He was shocked. He laughed. He was surprised, completely surprised. That's in where is it? It's right. And it's, excuse me, just one second. Yes. That's in 17 verses 17 and 18. See, Abraham fell on his face and he laughed. And he said, will a 100-year-old man give birth and with a Sarah, a wife of 90? And then Abraham said to God, Lu means like, it means, I only wish that Ishmael should live before you. So apparently at that point he thought that Ishmael was going to be the one that was going to carry on the tradition and the ideas of Abraham. But God knew otherwise, that Ishmael wasn't capable of doing that. So that's why God gave him Isaac, and God told him, through Isaac you are going to have seed. Now, once that became known to Abraham, obviously, where would his emotions of love fall? His emotions of love would naturally fall to that son. See, I want to explain something to you. A great person has emotions, too. This is always a problem in Judaism, because Judaism is very intellectual, and it's very much a religion of the mind. So then people say, where are the emotions? You have to understand, a great person has emotions, but a great person, his emotions are different than an ordinary person. In what manner? I guess the best example I could give you would be the case of Jacob. Jacob loved Joseph, right? We all know Jacob loved Joseph more than all his other children. But why did he love Joseph? An interesting thing. So the Torah says that this is in Genesis 37:3, and Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons. Why? Because he was, it says in Hebrew, he was to him a ben zekunim. What does it mean, ben zekunim? A son of his old age? That's the literal translation. There's a problem with that translation, a son of his old age, because he really wasn't much older when Joseph was born than it was within a year or so. It wasn't really much of a distance. Actually, later, the greater distance was between Joseph and Benjamin. So Benjamin should have been the older son. So Tirgum, Unculus the proselyte, translates, he says, the word Zokain means wise. He says, because what the Torah means is he loved him because he was a wise son. Now, what Unculus does with that translation is he's not just giving you a translation, he's showing you an idea, a concept, and that is that Jacob didn't love Joseph because he was Rachel's son. Correct? He loved him because he was a wise son. But we know as well that Joseph had special meaning to him because he was Rachel's son. So why did he love him? The answer is, essentially, he loved him because he was wise. If Joseph was not a wise son, if Joseph was a stupid son, he couldn't just love him because it's his wife's, his true wife. Jacob's true wife was really Rachel. Leah was really someone that imposed on his life. He wasn't happy with Leah. He didn't want Leah. As a matter of fact, that the Talmud said that he wanted to divorce her. And if you look at the verses, you can see this between the lines, because every time she had a child, she said, now my husband will love me. Now my husband will become attached to me. So she sensed the hostility from Jacob. Jacob really was fooled with Leah, and he was angry at her because she went along with Laban and fooled him. But he couldn't divorce her immediately because it wouldn't be appropriate. I mean, after all, he was working for her father, and he made a deal, and Laban was a very convincing businessman, and he coerced him sort of into it, and he couldn't get out of it right away, but the Talmud says that he really eventually wanted to get rid of her. He just was waiting his time. Meantime, he had these children, and then he said, am I going to divorce the mother of these children? Because he saw they were, he realized that these children are going to be the tribes are going to establish the whole nation. So he had a change of heart. But the truth of the matter is he always loved Rachel. That was the one that he really loved. And what happened was that when she had a child, that child, of course, had special meaning to him. But what Unculus is teaching us is that the great Jacob could not just love a child because it's the child of his favorite wife, of his true wife. Why? Because it's empty. See, a great person can enjoy a child, but not just the empty emotion of a child. If the child's intelligent, if the child is something special, then he enjoys the emotion as well. But just to enjoy the emotion, just because it happens to be his son, the son of this wife, and he's an ignorant son, and he's not intelligent, and he's not ethical, and there's nothing really great about him, he would never enjoy that son. Then his favorites would be the other brothers, the ones that have true quality. So the emotions of a great person, a person who is great, enjoys his emotions and the ideas of the Torah. But it must always be with ideas, with knowledge. I'll give you an example of friendship. Torah friendship is a different kind of friendship. Friendship in general is based upon common emotions. I mean, you have common feelings, you like the same movies, the same sports, whatever, some kind of commonality. But a Torah man really can't have such kind of a friend. He's a nice guy, he helps you, he's nice. You can have a friend like on a certain level. What is a true friend in the Torah world? In the Torah world, a true friend is a friend that you share the greatest gift of all, a friend that you share knowledge. And if you can't share knowledge with your friend, it really has very little meaning. The friendship has very little meaning. I mean, I know this is so in my personal life, and I know that many of you experience that same kind of a thing. So Torah raises the person to a level where his emotions, he enjoys the emotions of friendship, of course. But the friendship can't just be an empty friendship. It has to have ideas. It has to be with something, a higher element in it. If the higher element is lacking, then the emotions can't exist. Whereas with the ordinary person, all they have is the hollow emotion, you know, the shallow emotion, and that's, they just live with the emotion itself. So over here as well with Abraham, his favorite son was Isaac, because of the fact that he saw that, besides the fact that God told him, he saw the difference between Isaac and Ishmael. He saw Ishmael is not the one of the qualities, he has those qualities. But Isaac does have those qualities, and that's why he was attached to him and drawn to him, and he loved him, and it was his favorite son. So, but God didn't disclose immediately, he didn't tell him immediately, take Isaac. He told him first, grapple with the emotion of your sons. Which ones? Just think about it. Then once he conceded to that, each step of the way was another dimension of overcoming his emotions towards his children, and finally towards Isaac. So God is a teacher. God teaches man in a way that he doesn't just suddenly say, take your son Isaac. He gradually introduced him, so he learns. He overcame one emotion. Now the next step, and now the next step. And God didn't say where he's going to, where exactly the spot is that he's going to bring Isaac as a sacrifice. Why? Because as long as the spot was not finalized, in his mind he was still grappling with emotion. You see, there's a certain when you have a finality, your mind is finished with it. If God would have told him the place, that would have been a certain kind of finality. He didn't tell him the place. He kept him in suspense. The suspense caused him to constantly be involved in the conflict and the difficulty. And that's what God wanted him to do, to work over those emotions. That's what Rashi means over there, that God didn't tell him where. And the same thing, God used the same method with the prophet Jonah. Why? Because Jonah was reluctant to go to Nineveh. Why was he reluctant to go to Nineveh? Because he did not believe that these people deserve forgiveness. He believed Nineveh were wicked people. They deserve to be destroyed. And it bothered him. He felt that God should not give them a chance. They don't deserve a chance. They've reached a level where they're not human beings anymore. They deserve to be destroyed. But God saw differently. God said, no. He says, you go. And he says, but the speech I will give you later when you get there. Why? Because since Jonah was reluctant to go, and he didn't know what that speech was, he was kept in a state of suspense. What kind of a speech could it be? Will it be effective? Will it not be effective? He was hoping it wouldn't be effective. But God kept him in a state of suspense, so he had to grapple with his own emotion and his own desire not to go. So God is, when God reveals himself to man, he reveals himself to man as a teacher, primarily as a teacher. So the same thing is true with this verse that we took up with Abraham. Go from your land, from your birthplace, and from your father's house. You have to remove yourself from the most difficult one. The last one is the most difficult one, because that's the most potent. So where are you going to go? I'm not going to give you the security. You don't know where you're going to go. I'll show it to you in the future. Time he wandered. He wandered toa. The word says it said he wandered aimlessly. Ramban says. He says he wandered like a lost sheep through the desert. He didn't know where he was going, no destination. But in that wandering, he was able to overcome those emotions. Then, when God told him where the land is, the land of Canaan, so after he overcame those emotions, there was only one source of security that he had from that land. And that was actually the fact that this land is the land that God instructed him to live in, for no other reason than in the future generations, this land will be important to a nation that's going to live hundreds of years after his time. And the truth of the matter is that he moved to Canaan. It was a terrible place. because in Haran was the, he had his family there. He had Laban and the family. You see, he lived among the Canaanites, which he despised. As a matter of fact, you know very well, when his son Isaac needed to marry someone, so what did Abraham tell Eliezer? He said to him, he said, don't allow my son to marry one of these Canaanite from the Canaanite people, because they were very primitive. He says, but go to my family. And he sent them back to Haran.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Question. We have talked about faith before, what is faith, what is not faith. But would you not say that right here that Abraham exercised faith when he said that when God told him to go to a land that I will show you, and then Abraham left, would that not be a pure example of faith?
I wouldn't say that action itself is faith, because Abraham, you see, the way the rabbis explain, when a prophet receives a prophecy, he has no doubt about it. When a prophet receives a prophecy, it's like you're looking at that wall. He knows he's received the prophecy. No prophet ever doubts it. The experience of prophecy is one that the person who experiences it is certain about it, just as certain as he is of his senses. So he knew that God told him to do that. Now, once a person knows that God tells him to do that, he's instructed by God to do that, there's no doubt that he will do it. So I wouldn't say that that is a matter of faith, because he knows that God told him, I will tell you in the future. He believes God. He doesn't think God is going to tell him a lie. So it's as sure as you cannot have any greater security than that. That's a great guarantee. If God says, I will tell you, he knew God will tell him. So that really wasn't such a great thing. The important thing over here was, the greatness over here was, to experience being alone, wandering aimlessly, to leave your family, to leave all those emotions, all those ties. That was his greatness. That was where the greatness of the man emerges. And what happened was, God told him, once you broke all those ties, now there's only one security that you're going to have. The security of living in a land which is tied up with my divine plan. It has no other value. It doesn't have anything else. You're among strangers, people that you really look down upon, idolaters. You don't want your children to even have anything to do with these people. But you're living here for one reason, because this is part of my divine plan, and my divine plan demands that the people that will emerge from you generations later, centuries later, these people will have a special, this land will be special to them, because they will think, my forefather Abraham, the one who discovered God, he lived here. So when I live in Israel, it reminds me of the ideas of an Abraham. And because of that, that's why I want you to live here. So the only security, Abraham forfeited all the emotional security that a normal person has with regard to his, where he lives, his family, his friends. And he lived alone, all alone, wandered alone. But the only security that he had was the security that he's living in the place that God instructed him to live, and part of the divine plan. That is the real security. That's a security not of the emotions, that's a security of the mind, where the person's knowledge tells them that the notion of security had to be removed, you see, there's a process of removing it from the emotional life and reattaching it to the world of knowledge of God. So this verse, which, as I said, when you look at it on the first sight, it looks like a very simple verse, but when you analyze it carefully, a whole new picture emerges. Yes.
We got another little question along this line.
Rabbi, you just explained this security that he had.
Yes.
I'm having problem understanding how he can have this security and still aimlessly.
Oh, okay. Let me clarify that point. I'm sorry, that's my fault. There were two parts to the process. First, there was the wandering aimlessly, where he suffered, and he had to remove all the emotions of the ties. That was the first process. Once he removed those emotions and he got rid of that, now God told him where the land is, and then he attached himself to that land, and the attachment was a pure one. It wasn't an attachment where he were of substitution. He didn't substitute the emotions of the previous attachment to this land, because he rid himself of the emotions by being alone and wandering. Once he rid himself of those attachments and he thought them through and he understood them, then he was ready to have an attachment, a pure attachment, to the land of Israel, which is the land that God instructed, part of the divine plan. That's when he was able to do it. But he would never be able to do that if he couldn't study, analyze, understand, and remove those powerful emotions. He would never be able to attach himself to the true idea of security. In order to reach the true idea of security, you have to break through the false idea of security. If you don't break through the false idea, you'll never be able to reach the true idea. So that wandering was a perfection, a process of perfection that Abraham underwent. Then he was able to attach himself to the true idea. Okay? Is that clear?
Your statement is clear, but I don't know if it's playing in Athens or not. The point is, and we only have about 2 minutes, so we might want to pick this up next go-round, is the fact that there has to be some type of faith, belief in God, in order either what he's seen God do in the past or what he's done for others, that he has this faith in God that he's going to accomplish what he said.
Well, it would be impossible. I mean, you know, from that standpoint, it would be impossible. I mean, if the President of the United States told you, well, I don't know, if you had someone who was trustworthy and they guaranteed you a job, if you do, they guaranteed you certain, they gave you a certain security, guaranteed you a certain sum of money, and the person was an honorable person, you certainly would feel secure about that. Now, with God, God's guarantee is the greatest guarantee. If a person doesn't feel secure, if God says you're going to do something, and a person is doubtful about that, that's not a matter of faith. That's an idiot. I mean, it's a person that just doesn't have any idea of God. Once a person knows God, knows what God, and has an idea of God, and God communicates to them, and God tells them that such and such is going to take place, is going to be done, there's no reason for faith anymore. There can't be anything more real. I mean, what could you put your faith in more than the source of all creation? You don't need faith. This is knowledge.
Don, you're slow on the button. We've got 20 seconds left. Yeah, 20 seconds. So we'll just stop right there.
Okay.
And pick it up the next time. And I apologize for that squeal. I was waiting for Don to turn it down, and he was waiting on me to push or something.
Okay, it's Don's fault.
Yeah, it's Don's fault.